We certainly know what grizzly bears look like in our part of the world, but generally not from in-person contact. That's always a good thing. A grizzly adorns the California state flag, though no grizzlies are known to live in the state of California. And that's a concern for some environmental groups. Grizzlies are on the endangered species list, therefore should be restored to their historic range, and that's not happening. Thus far, grizzly recovery efforts in the lower 48 states are focused on a pocket of land that includes Idaho, Montana, and Washington, among others. The Center for Biological Diversity proposes a change in strategy. Noah Greenwald is the endangered species director for the Center for Biological Diversity based in Tucson, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey.
Give people who don't know your organization the thumbnail sketch about what the center's about.
Sure. The Center for Biological Diversity is a national organization that focuses on protecting endangered species and their habitats. We have over 775,000 members and supporters all over the country, and we're just fierce advocates for saving endangered species from extinction.
Well, fierce is a good word. I was going to ask if you're fairly aggressive in pursuit of wildlife protection and expansion, and it sounds like by the use of that verb, you are.
Yeah.
Would you say, then, that you're very busy, generally, because of the fact that there are so many species that need some attention?
Yeah, we definitely have our work cut out for us. You know, most scientists who, you know, work on conservation and are concerned with these issues believe we're in what's called the sixth great extinction crisis. So, you know, like extinction events in the past, such as when the dinosaurs were wiped out by a meteor, species are going extinct at a very rapid rate, except for unlike past extinction events, the cause is us. And it's because all over the planet we're destroying habitats, we're moving species around, creating invasive species problems, we're polluting water, we're impacting the environment in all kinds of ways that's leading to species being in trouble and going extinct.
I had a chance to read recently about the earlier five great extinctions. We got pretty close to not having life on Earth in a couple of those, didn't we?
Yeah, that's true. That, you know, I think like the Permian extinction, when there was a rapid change in the atmosphere, at least that's what they think, more than 90% of all species went extinct, and it took a long time to recover.
What was left after the Permian extinction?
You know, one of the things that I remember reading about this that was kind of interesting is that there was, you know, you had these, you know, small number of species that would be super dominant for, you know, a million or 2 years. And one of the things I remember is one was sort of like a pig-like animal that after, I think it was after the Permian extinction, that was around for like a million or 2 million years, basically everywhere. And so, you know, that's what you'd end up with is you'd end up with, I don't know what it'll be after our extinction event if we don't turn things around, you know, rats or cockroaches or whatever it'll be. It'll be super dominant and we'll fluctuate around in that way. Hopefully that won't happen.
All right, so back to the grizzly bears themselves. Was an argument in favor of grizzly range expansion just a logical extension of the usual work at the Center for Biological Diversity?
Well, yes. You know, the loss of large predators like grizzly bears or wolves or sharks or lions or whatever it is a global problem. You know, people have been wiping out these large predators across the planet, and it causes a lot of problems because apex predators like grizzly bears, like wolves, have a lot of influence over ecosystems, and they help maintain the health of those ecosystems. So the loss of these large predators has led to problems really everywhere, just about. And so that's something we're very concerned about and something we've been working hard to reverse. And, you know, it is quite possible. If you look at Europe right now, actually, Europe has seen a big recovery of bears and wolves, even though there's relatively high population densities. So, for example, there's now wolves within about 70 miles of Berlin.
Really?
Yeah.
And is there a bear comparable to the grizzly on the European landmass?
Yeah, the European brown bear. It's basically a grizzly bear.
And is that pretty much limited to pockets like the grizzly bear is in the lower 48?
It is, but it's been recovering. You know, it's gained in range. You know, it was, you know, it's largely limited to the Balkans, Romania. Since then, it's now in France and Italy and Spain, in the Pyrenees, in Switzerland. They recently have had bears come back. So it's, you know, it's really starting to make a comeback.
Let's talk about grizzly bears just on some basic levels. For one thing, the size. I mean, how big are these bears? How much do they weigh? And where was their historic range?
So grizzly bears can be up to 1,000 pounds. It's a big animal. And their historic range was the western U.S., so from the Great Plains all the way to the coast, and then from Alaska down through Mexico. So a pretty big range. They weren't in the eastern deciduous forest. They were basically the Great Plains over. But they were, you know, extensive in that range, and including in California, they were fairly abundant. From the coast all the way to the crest of the Sierra Nevada.
All right, many more questions to ask, many more answers to come from Noah Greenwald about the process of perhaps getting the endangered species or the grizzly on the endangered species list expanded into new parts of its historic range or parts that it once occupied, now as new. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Back with Noah Greenwald and you on grizzly bears in a minute 15. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about grizzly bears, about the proposal to reintroduce grizzly bears in a larger portion of their historic range in the lower 48 states. The proposal on the table includes a mention of habitat areas in both California and Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Noah Greenwald, the Endangered Species Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Within the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. No, I want to come back to the discussion of the grizzly historically, because when you mentioned that it was very much a Western creature, all the way down into Mexico and as far north as Alaska, certainly, this bespeaks that this is a very adaptable creature that can survive in a lot of different kinds of environments.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure true. You know, it was a creature of the mountains, creature of the plains, and a creature of the coast.
Were there subspecies in Mexico or Southern California or any of the drier, warmer places within its range?
There were some subspecies, and in fact, California, the bears that were in California were considered to be a subspecies. You know, whether that, with modern genetic techniques, whether that would hold up still, you know, is sort of an open question, but that subspecies is now believed extinct.
Let us take a call. Here's Mark in Redding, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noah Greenwald. We're talking grizzly bears.
Good morning. Remember reading the first experience of European Americans with grizzly bears, at least the first I know of, which was the Lewis and Clark expedition, when they were overwintering with the Mandan on their way west. The Mandan told them about this large brown bear, and they thought, okay, fine. They came west, and they came across one, and they, of course, shot it, and it died almost immediately. Well, no big deal. Some while later, they came across another one. They shot it and shot it and shot it, and it didn't die. They had a terrible time killing this thing, and I think it was Clark noted in his log that the expedition that felt that they'd had quite enough experience with these bears and would appreciate not having any more.
Right, so that's quite an interesting view of the earlier encounters of white settlers and grizzlies. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate that. Interesting thing to consider that as people moved further west, then they did begin to encounter creatures that they didn't see in the east, grizzlies among them, Noah. And so was the general reaction like, well, these are a pest, let's get rid of them, and blam, they just began taking them out?
Well, so grizzly bears, along with wolves and many other animals and large predators, were wiped out by a concerted campaign of the U.S. government, actually. And it was largely a campaign that was designed to benefit the livestock industry. You know, so we poisoned, trapped, shot wolves, bears, mountain lions to the point of extinction in most of the country. And that, as I said, that was an effort that was led largely by the U.S. government.
What do we know about numbers of grizzly bears at the peak before westward expansion, and I'm sure it's only an estimate, obviously, versus what we know now about grizzly bears currently alive in the United States and Western Canada, for that matter?
Right. So, there's not really great estimates for how many grizzly bears there were, but, you know, people place the number at somewhere between 50 and 100,000 in the western U.S., today, there's roughly 1,500 to 1,800 bears, less than 5% of their historic numbers in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, just in portions of the northern Rockies, which amounts to less than 5% of their historic range, and actually less than 4% of their historic range, and somewhere around 20% of suitable habitat that scientists estimate are out there.
How long ago were grizzly bears placed on the endangered species list?
They were placed on the endangered species list in 1975, and at that point they were, down to, somewhere around a few hundred bears in Yellowstone and a few hundred bears in Glacier National Park. So in those two areas, in Yellowstone and Glacier, they have seen quite a bit of recovery. There's now around 700 bears in Yellowstone and roughly 800 bears in Glacier.
Well, 1975 suggests that this is an early occupant of the endangered species list, not very long after the passage of the Endangered Species Act itself.
That's right. That's right. It was one of the original ones to get protected, along with wolves.
And is it listed as threatened or endangered?
It's listed as endangered.
And is there any particular difference in the treatment, any greater urgency to a recovery plan for an endangered species versus threatened?
It depends, that kind of varies actually, endangered is the higher category, it means that there's more risk of extinction. So sometimes there is more urgency.
So when we talk about, the methods used thus far with grizzlies, has there actually been any work going on in Alaska, or are they plentiful enough there that they really haven't need much assistance?
They're not listed, actually. They're not protected in Alaska. Mm-hmm. They're just protected in the lower 48 states. And there's still quite a few bears up in Alaska.
Have the grizzlies then been reintroduced anywhere in the lower 48, or just sort of allowed to expand within the ranges that they were confined to?
The closest that we've come to, an actual reintroduction is there's been bears that have been moved from Glacier National Park into an area called the Cabinet Yak, which is a little bit further west in Idaho and Montana, in order to augment that population. So we've done some population augmentation, particularly of that Cabinet Yak population. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, actually, under the Clinton administration, had a proposed rule to reintroduce bears into what's known as the Selway Bitterroot. It's an area of central Idaho crossing the border into Montana, an area of extensive habitat. And that, with the change in election to the Bush administration, they withdrew that rule. Actually, they didn't withdraw that rule. They proposed to withdraw that rule, which they never finalized. So technically, it's still somewhat on the books. But that was the closest we came. And from our perspective, that's one of the first places that they should be looking to reintroduce bears.
All right, so let's talk about this idea of reintroduction, because one of the major bones, obviously, you pick with the feds, and I had a chance to look at the document you provided to the Interior Secretary and the Fish and Wildlife Service Director. It points out that there's usually a list of things that happen with any creature on the endangered species list, and you're pointing out they really haven't finished the list.
That's right. So what our petition asks for is for them to revise their 1993 recovery plan and to consider additional areas for recovery. And this is something that they themselves have actually acknowledged they need to do. So in 2011, they did a five-year review of the bear, and they concluded just almost exactly what I said, that the 1993 plan no longer represented the best available science and needed to be updated, and that they should consider additional areas in California, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico.
Is that a fairly hot potato for the Fish and Wildlife Service and for anybody involved politically anyway? I mean, the grizzly certainly conjures up some scary stuff for a lot of people, as do wolves. We've watched that process around this part of the country as well. Is it just a matter of political will and bucking some fear to be able to talk about actually implementing a plan like that?
Yeah, it is definitely about political will. And, you know, I think it's a tough issue for Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, their tendency is to avoid controversy. And this is something where I think, you know, it would draw large public support in California in particular, but there would be people who were upset as well. So it would generate some controversy. It is something that is quite possible, though. Actually, I just checked, and I'm sorry, grizzly bears are actually threatened. I apologize.
Threatened, not endangered. Okay.
Not endangered.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you for that correction. Noah Greenwald's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Endangered Species Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. We are talking about grizzly bears, which are listed as threatened in the lower 48 states, and a proposal from the Center for Biological Diversity to the Interior Department and the Fish and Wildlife Service to expand the ranges in which grizzly bear habitat is provided in the lower 48. Which could potentially mean parts of both California and Oregon. Both are listed in the primary and secondary ideas of places that could be useful. Join us on the exchange as we talk about whether grizzlies should get greater range preservation. 800-838-3760 around the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. While we're talking about the politics, then, I'm just curious to know how fierce an internal debate this might have been within the Center for Biological Diversity.
Wait, say that again, Jeffrey?
I'm just curious to know if there was much debate within the Center for Biological Diversity about making this appeal to the Interior Secretary and Fish and Wildlife Service Director.
No, I think this is something that's, you know, really squarely within our mission, restoring, you know, something as majestic and beautiful as grizzly bears to more of their historic range is something that is, you know, something that we support here at the Center for Biological Diversity.
I noticed in reading up on this, the concept that the Fish and Wildlife Service seems to have floated at various times of the non-essential experimental population. What does that mean?
So there's, under the Endangered Species Act, there's a section called 10J, which allows for reintroduction of species to portions of their range where they've been lost. And they can do that either as a non-essential experimental population or as an essential experimental population, although they always do it as a non-essential experimental population. And essentially it means that, you know, you can reintroduce it, but it won't have the same level of regulatory protection that other listed species would. So it kind of relaxes the regulations as, I guess, somewhat of a incentive, or so it doesn't deter the ability to reintroduce.
It sounds like writing something down in pencil so you can potentially erase it later rather than writing it in pen.
Well, I wouldn't say that. What I would say is it's designed to, you know, reduce obstacles to reintroduction. So, and there's, you know, been lots of examples of non-essential experimental populations being reintroduced, including the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico, gray wolves into Yellowstone National Park and central Idaho were reintroduced as experimental non-essential, and lynx in Colorado were reintroduced that way, black-footed ferret. So there's a lot of examples, and it's basically so that people don't feel like something's going to be reintroduced and then their activities are going to be regulated.
Ah, okay. To give some solace to the people who are afraid they're going to have to cut logging or mining or something.
Right.
Let's take a call. We have Bobby in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noah Greenwald from the Center for Biological Diversity. We're talking grizzly bears.
Yeah, I come from an unfortunately bear hunting background, which I reject and very angry about. I wonder how you're going to deal with the human factor in this, because unfortunately, there are so many people out there that want to see a wolf or a bear shot on sight, the ranchers and the others, and then there's those idiot trophy hunters. How can you reintroduce a grizzly bear when there is so much of these redneck shoot 'em up and kill 'em population out there that's going to kill the animals that you're trying to put in? You know, like there was that OR7 wolf that they've been tracking. My golly, if any of the ranchers or that around knew where he was, he'd be dead. Him and his pups and his mate all would be dead in a minute if they knew where they could get to him. And I really get upset about the media coverage of the wolf and his family, because they aren't going to last with that sort of thing going on. In Kentucky, there we get the Wildlife and Environmental magazines. There was a wolf that showed up, and guess what? First thing, they shot it. First wolf in how many hundred years, and it was shot. So how do you deal with the human destructive pattern that is going to really be a problem for your reintroduction of any grizzlies or wolves or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the question, Bobby. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so that is, you know, one of the challenges with reintroductions. You know, certainly the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona, New Mexico suffered from that problem where there was poaching. And, you know, that is something that is illegal and comes with stiff penalties under the Endangered Species Act, and that would be true of the grizzly bear as well. You know, one of the things, you know, that you know, we said in this petition, and one of the things that scientists have identified as a key factor in providing suitable habitat is areas with few roads. And, you know, it's not because bears or wolves, you know, can't live around roads. It's because roads provide access to people who then shoot them. So, you know, in California, there are areas that are wild enough and remote enough that bears could survive in those areas without getting shot. In particular, in the Sierra Nevada, particularly the southern Sierra Nevada around Sequoia, Kings Canyon, John Muir Wilderness, Kern Plateau, that area is very remote. Some of the remotest country, some of the remotest areas in the country. And so that's definitely an area where, you know, we would target first for putting bears back in California. And actually, that's where the last bears in California were seen in the 1920s, was in Sequoia National Park.
And as far as anybody knows, there simply aren't any in California in the wild anymore, right?
No, there's definitely not. That's something that people would know for sure.
Something that Bobby brought up in her discussion, though, begs the question about behavior of bears toward livestock. As you pointed out, a lot of the extirpation of bears and wolves in the first place was to benefit the livestock industry. Do bears prey upon livestock?
Bears and both bears and wolves do sometimes prey on livestock. That, you know, was one of the primary reasons why they were wiped out. You know, in the last 30 years, we've really learned a lot about living with bears and wolves, and in particular, there's a lot of practices that ranchers can use to help protect their stock. You know, things like having range riders, using fencing during calving season, guard dogs. Those are all things that have proven to be effective. And actually, you know, when it comes right down to it, the whole idea of, you know, creating a predator-free landscape for livestock really didn't work. It worked to remove wolves and bears, but it didn't work with coyotes. Coyotes were able to adapt to it, and in fact, you know, getting rid of wolves led to a major expansion in coyotes, which also prey on livestock. So it didn't have the intended effect anyway. These other methods work better to protect livestock than does just trying to kill them all off the landscape.
Noah, is there less of a constituency for grizzlies, you think, than for wolves? I mean, wolves are close enough to pets. I mean, people, you know, they look at OR7's picture and they go, oh, doggy, but nobody really feels that way about grizzlies, I'm going to guess.
You know, actually, it's kind of interesting. I think if you look at the Northern Rockies, which has both, Wolves seem to inspire really strong passions on both sides. You know, from the livestock industry, wolves are, you know, for some people comparable to the devil, really. You know, they just see it as a horrible animal, whereas people, you're right, people just love them. Whereas bears, they don't seem to excite us that same level of hatred that wolves do, which is interesting. And you look at Montana, for example, the Grizzlies are University of Montana's.
Sure, their mascot.
Mascot, the Bears for Cal, the Cal Bears. That's a grizzly on the state flag. So, you know, I think they do inspire a lot.
All right, much more to talk about with Noah Greenwald about the idea of expanding the habitat for grizzly bears in the lower 48. We'll come back and talk more with Noah and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is the concept of reintroducing grizzly bears in broader parts of the lower 48 states. This is a proposal that comes to the Fish and Wildlife Service and to the Interior Department, the head agency for the Fish and Wildlife Service at the federal level, from the Center for Biological Diversity, where Noah Greenwald is the Endangered Species Director and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join this discussion. Lots to talk about here. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the grizzly bear recovery plan in the lower 48 dates back to 1993. You pointed out the Fish and Wildlife Service's own review in 2011 said it might be time to think about this differently. What specifically are you requesting from Fish and Wildlife and the Interior Department?
Yeah, so we're specifically requesting that they revise their 1993 recovery plan, and in so doing that they consider these additional areas and determine if they're suitable for recovery and necessary for recovery. And those areas include, first and foremost, the Sierra Nevada, the Uintas in Utah, the Gila Mogollon Complex in Arizona, New Mexico, the Grand Canyon area, and then some secondary areas I would note in particular is the Klamath Siskiyou. You know, in your area down there, has an extensive amount of habitat. It's kind of fragmented up into different parts. So it would need some looking at to see if it was sufficient to support a population or not.
As you look at these places, the Mogollon Rim and Gila Complex, Sierra Nevada, Grand Canyon, Uinta Mountains, and then the secondary list, which includes the Klamath Siskiyou, are you looking for a lot of contiguity in addition to areas with very few roads?
Yeah, I mean, it's better if you have a large block of habitat, and it's better if it's connected to other habitat areas, which, you know, something like the Sierra Nevada is a little bit of a struggle in that sense of that it would be an island population. It wouldn't be connected to other populations, so it would need some management moving forward. But, you know, it could support a decent-sized population, you know, somewhere four, maybe 300-500 bears, something like that. And then, you know, in addition to that, you know, for where bears already occur in the northern Rockies, there needs to be more of a focus on connectivity between existing populations. And there needs to be more done around those populations to secure bears as they move, as they expand their range. And so some of those things are, and you know, this is stuff that people who live in sort of the urban wildland interface should be doing or are doing, which is to make sure that trash is secured, to ensure that roads have crossings that wildlife can access. So, you know, this is, you know, stuff that we need to do to make the landscape secure for grizzly bears or stuff that we already should be doing for black bears or other wildlife that we already coexist with.
This concept of islands, though, or pockets where you just have grizzly bears here and there, but not any particular connectivity to other populations, is this something of great concern as you make proposals like this?
It's definitely something to be aware of. You know, they're, you know, part of why we're pushing this right now is because they're moving to delist bears in Yellowstone National Park. They want to draw a circle around the Yellowstone area and call it recovered. And one of our concerns is that, you know, those bears aren't connected to other populations, so they will continue to need management. In addition, you know, there's some additional concerns about those bears. You know, in particular, they've lost one of their key food sources, which is white bark pine, to climate change. So there's some cause for concern for that population. And then we're just concerned that they'll do something similar to what they've done with wolves, which they drew a circle around the Northern Rockies, then they drew a circle around the Great Lakes, and they, you know, called them recovered, and then now they're moving to delist wolves around the rest of the country, excluding the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico. And, you know, similar to wolves, as with bears, we don't believe the job of recovery is done. And, you know, wolves, for example, there's habitat in Colorado, extensive habitat in Colorado and Utah. Wolves are just beginning to move into western Washington, Oregon, and California.
Is this a pretty firm line you take at the Center for Biological Diversity, that recovery means recovery across its historic range?
Yeah, and this is, you know, the Endangered Species Act actually defines a species as endangered if it's at risk of extinction in all or significant portions of its range. So essentially, you can't consider a species recovered if it's still gone from or at risk in significant portions of its range. And, you know, for wolves, you know, certainly western, all of, you know, the whole West Coast from western Washington to western Oregon to California, from our perspective, is a significant portion of range. Likewise with grizzly bears, as I said, they're only in 4% of their historic range and only about 20% of what scientists have considered to be suitable habitat. So from our perspective, you know, that 80% of their range that they could still occupy is certainly a significant portion.
I can see an opportunity here, though, for fun with lawyers, Noah, because is the Endangered Species Act explicit in saying historic range, or can the Fish and Wildlife Service say, well, the range now? I mean, they're restored across the range that exists now.
Well, that's what they're trying to say, actually. I mean, it's astute of you to note that, because that is actually what they're trying to argue. And there is at least one court, the Ninth Circuit, actually, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, said that they can't do that, that they at least have to look at historic range and explain why it's not significant. And, you know, from our perspective, if that's the position you take, that it's current range, then it's a shifting baseline. You know, then, you know, every time something loses range, that becomes the new standard, you know. And so, you know, you have a situation where you have a species that's in 4% of its historic range, and then you just, you know, are you just going to recover it to that? That doesn't make any sense, you know. And there's some other aspects, there's some other parts of the Endangered Species Act that suggest that that isn't at all what Congress intended, including the significant portion of range part of that. The Endangered Species Act explicitly allows for designation of critical habitat in areas where species don't currently occur. So from our perspective, that is just not what the Endangered Species Act said. It's not in the interest of the American public. It's not in the interest of the conservation of species to just, you know, manage species like they're in zoos, essentially.
We have some calls waiting here. Let's go to John in Vinita, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noah Greenwald. We're talking grizzly bears.
Jeffrey, Noah, first thing I want to say is I would love to see this happen. I really would. I'm a hunter and all, but I don't have any interest in nothing but seeing tracks and large predators. To me, it's a comfort. But being a long, well, a native Oregonian, lived here for a long time of my life, which is a long time. I can go back 40 years when California started really moving up here in droves, and I can just fill up a book with people that would come up, and they think they're going on to the Disney Channel. And then a coyote or a cat would get one of their dogs or cats or something, and they'd freak totally out. And, I mean, totally out. And we're not even close to grizzly image here. I've helped people secure their place. Tell them, no, you can't leave your dog food out in the back porch. You can't leave your garbage can and secured. because, you know, the bear's going to come around. It's not because they're scary or dangerous necessarily, but you don't wouldn't want to get cross-legged with them. But grizzlies now, that's different. It's all there. It's all historical. You can look at cougars are just about zero threat to man. I mean, very, very, very few incidents. Wolves, same thing, in North American wolves. Grizzlies, different thing, especially if you get tangled up with them and they misunderstand what's going on. And if they can't, you know, these people cannot figure out how to adapt to that, they won't make it 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to see that, but that's because we're overrun with humanity.
All right. So
anyway.
Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Never going to happen. What do you think, Noah?
Well, so I think, you know, the fact that, well, grizzly bears don't generally attack people, but they have an adaptation whereby they aggressively defend their cubs. So it's a dangerous situation if you surprise a sow with cubs. You know, they'll charge at you, and they do occasionally maul people. So that is something that's a concern with grizzly bears. I think, you know, right now there's over 1 million visitors a year to Yellowstone National Park. There's, you know, very few incidences where people get injured by grizzly bears or killed by grizzly bears, though it does happen. And it really takes education about, you know, how you act when you're in the backcountry. That's, you know, something we would have to work on. But it's something that we know a lot more about than we ever used to. You know, so people in Alaska, people in Montana, people in Idaho, people in Wyoming have adapted to having bears in their environment. And I think, you know, from most people's perspective, it's a real benefit. You know, certainly if you've been to Yellowstone, you know that if there's a grizzly bear anywhere, people just stop, they take pictures, they look at them. It's just a very exciting event. And so, you know, I think there's some, you know, risk that needs to be mitigated through education. But from, you know, our perspective, that's outweighed by the benefit. It's a very slight risk. You know, if there were bears, say, in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park, driving up to the park would certainly be quite a bit more dangerous than just being in the park with bears. You know, likewise, you know, in Yellowstone National Park, it's actually not bears that injure the most people. It's actually moose. Moose are pretty dangerous in the spring when they have calves, and mm-hmm. then in the fall when they're rutting.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's take another call. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noah Greenwald from the Center for Biological Diversity.
Good morning, Mr. Greenwald. This is a wonderful idea. However, I think that you need to back away honestly and respectfully from total range. The reality of the situation is much of the range of the grizzly has been occupied, at least in some way, with the urban-rural interfaces in many communities. I'm a native Oregonian like John, and I tend to agree with John and what he does. I live on the interface. I'm very mindful in terms of domestic animals versus wild animals. A large, matter of fact, two-thirds of my property is left to the wild things, so they have a place. And I have no problem with cougars because cougars are generally not going to be a problem. I have no problems with black bears coming through and using the blackberries, taking advantage of them. That's what they do. It's to be expected. The dogs I have are outside dogs, but they have a secure panic room, for lack of a better term, if something's coming after him. The turkey's on his own. But the long and the short of it is, when you're talking about a grizzly bear, you are talking about an apex predator that is incredibly intelligent and has been known to stalk people, and it's a very, very dangerous, dangerous creature to reintroduce into the urban-rural interface. And
right.
And I'd like to know how you're going to stop that from happening.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul.
Sure. So we're not saying total range, you know, and our petition absolutely doesn't say total range. I mean, clearly there's a lot of areas that are no longer suitable for grizzly bears because there's just too many people. And so the areas we've identified were identified by scientists who modeled habitat that's still considered suitable for bears. And one of the key factors in that model is road densities, and road densities are basically an indicator of where there's people, because if there's not roads, there's generally not people. So that's why something like Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park, combined with the John Muir Wilderness, combined with the Kern Plateau, that whole area in the Southern Sierra comes up because it's a road-free area. And there's parts of the Klamath Siskiyou that are road-free, although they're somewhat fragmented from each other. Mm-hmm. And so that's why that area is, you know, maybe a little bit more of a challenge than, say, the Sierra Nevada is. You know, similarly, like the, you know, the Gila Mogollon area in Arizona, New Mexico is, you know, one of the largest roadless areas. The Selway Bitterroot in Idaho, that actually is the largest roadless area in the country.
Right, Noah, we're almost out of time. There is a threat of a lawsuit implied, certainly, in the documentation to the Interior Department. Is there any calendar if you don't get a favorable response?
Yeah, so we filed the petition under the Administrative Procedures Act, and so they don't have a hard deadline by which they have to reply. But if they do have to reply, and if they didn't, then we would sue them. And then when they do reply, depending on what they say, then we'd have to evaluate at that point whether we want to challenge.
All right. We will see what the response is from the Interior Secretary and or the Fish and Wildlife Service Director, both of whom were addressed in the petition from the Center for Biological Diversity to expand the areas in which the grizzly bears are allowed habitat in the lower 48. Noah Greenwald, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Jeffrey.
Pleasure.